Hi everyone, my name is Anne and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Mark, for inviting me to come share. Thank you, Christina, for your 10 minutes. It was excellent. Welcome.
Just a little bit.
Little higher. No, welcome to Gabriel and Luigi. It was your first time at this group. Welcome, and welcome to our new friends. I want you to know that Alcoholics Anonymous works, and it works really well. And it works despite having a bad attitude and not wanting to do it. As long as you do it, it works. So I'm grateful to be here, and I'm grateful to be sober. This is a wonderful meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you don't have a home group, this would be a wonderful home group. I'm not telling you what to do, but this is a really great meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I don't like being told what to do. Anyway, I'm just going to share with you what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. My sobriety date's May 29th, 2004. My sponsor is Karen. She lives in Long Beach. She's been my sponsor all 20 years. And I have sponsees. And my home group is Old Town Speakers. It's a Sunday night speaker meeting right off the 8 down there in San Diego at the First United Methodist Church. It meets Sunday night at 7 p.m. So if you're ever down there, you're more than welcome to join us. And there's two different recovery meetings in that church that night, so we're in Linder Hall. Anyway, I was born and raised in Iowa. Silence. And I have two younger brothers, a mom and a dad, and neither one of my parents were alcoholic. I didn't know what alcoholism was other than my mom telling me that her dad was alcoholic. Her dad died from delirium tremens when he was 43 years old, and my mom was 15, and I never knew that person. And they were from North Carolina, and I was raised in Iowa because my dad moved to Iowa for his job. And so I had a parent that had mental illness, and sometimes that parent was medicated and sometimes they weren't. And I remember feeling full of fear as a child, and I remember feeling very irritated as a child. Those are my two predominant emotions. And having like a mentally ill parent and stuff, and all the stuff that went along with that in my home, where we had to keep a lot of secrets and things like that, it doesn't make me alcoholic. But I just tell you that because I used to blame that all the time for how I felt and the way I was. I'm like, that's why I'm the way I am. It's my family's fault. And really, I'm an alcoholic because when I put alcohol into my body, I want another drink and I want another drink and I don't know what's going to happen. And I often go into a blackout and then I do things I wouldn't do sober. And that cycle gets repeated over and over again. And so I, as a young person, I just remember feeling I was full of self-centered fear. I'd be on the playground at 5 years old thinking like, what do I say? How did you know what to say to each other? How did you know to use those words right then? And like, da-da-da-da, and my head was just really busy, right? And then I was like, I hate all of you. And it was just this constant thing. And in eighth grade, my parents went away for their anniversary, which was also May 29th. So the first day I drank is also the same as my sobriety day, just with a lot of years in between. I can't plan that. And my parents went away for their anniversary, and I used to always say that I took it from my parents' basement. I thought it was my parents' booze, but apparently I stole from my father's employer. I did not know that. My parents had had a party in the house, and they had had crates of hard liquor in the basement. And so I invited two eighth grade boys over and an eighth grade girl over, and I got a bottle of Jose Cuervo out, and it was not opened, and I uncapped the bottle, and I was supposed to be watching my two brothers. One was 2 years younger than me, but one was 4 at the time. I did not watch them that night. And at the time, I just wanted to be up to no good. I was just a teenager. I wanted to do something, you know, a little bit rebellious or whatever. And I was in a very small town in Iowa. There wasn't a lot going on. And so it's just the truth. And so I took a drink, and I felt it go down, and I was like, all this kind of like, and I mean, it was kind of exciting because I thought I might get in trouble. And I didn't have a timeout dad. I was brought up in the age where I still got hit, you know. And so I was like, okay, it was kind of exciting. And I just remember like that first feeling of, and just really settling my mind and really being able to not be so busy thinking about 10 things in here and be present with my friends. And that was really cool. And then I started to pass the bottle around, and then I had another few swigs out of the bottle, and I got really warm, and I began to laugh, and I was having a really great time. And then I engaged in some inappropriate behavior for an eighth grade girl, and then I thought to myself, these boys are going to drink my booze, and they can get their own. And I locked myself in the guest bedroom, and I drank the rest of the bottle. And then it was 4 in the morning, and I was on the top floor of the house, and I had been in the basement of the house, and my friends were gone, and my parents were home, and I don't know where my brothers are or the bottle. And that pretty much sums up how I drink. So It really does. And I always gravitated towards hard liquor, and I got away with it. And I didn't worry that I didn't remember half the night, or how did I go from a bottom floor to a top floor of a house. And I didn't think about any of those things. I was like, that was cool, you know. And I was a good student, and I was in sports, and I was in choirs, and I did all the things. And I was in a tiny town in Iowa, and I wanted to be a good girl, and I started drinking on the weekends. And I never drank normally, ever. I remember one time I tried to control and enjoy my drinking, and I was an adult, and I was at a brunch with my friend's parents, and it was Thanksgiving, and I'd had a few margaritas before the appetizers were even there, and they were looking at me funny, and I was about to order like my fourth margarita, and they were looking at me weird, and I was like, oh, they're gonna think I'm an alcoholic. And so I slowed it down. I didn't stop, but I slowed it down, and then I drank when I got home, and I was miserable, and all I thought about was drinking the whole rest of that meal. But it was so annoying. But anyway, I had consequences happen at a young age. I got pregnant in blackouts twice. I don't always say that from the podium, but I, for whatever reason, feel really comfortable with all of you guys. And I stopped doing what gets you pregnant. I don't look at my drinking. And I was in the back of some police cars at 14 years old, 15 years old. And, you know, at that point in time, the boys went to jail and the little blonde girl goes home with her mommy, you know, and that's what was happening in small town Iowa. Even though the police officer may have been screaming at me, you want to blink and be arrested, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay. And I was drunk, so I was like, whatever, man. And so I end up graduating from high school with good grades, like all the stuff. And my mom was saying, Ann, you're a budding alcoholic. Because I'm sorry, I'm kind of all over the place, but my parents got divorced when I was around 16. And that's when my dad left, and he was kind of the disciplinarian. And that's when it was on for me. And I started to drink daily. And when I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking. And I'd always get the Everclear or the vodka or whatever was, you know, I found the bikers with the whiskey in their saddlebags at the parties, you know, and I was like, I needed that stuff before I came up with my little red Solo cup at the keg, you know. And I always thought it was a mystery to me how people socialized when they were drinking for long periods of time, because I was the girl, like, down the front steps of the house. Like, I was always more or less insanely drunk, as our book talks about. But, you know, it was the solution for me. It helped me breathe in and out. It helped me live day by day and not think about the pain and the shame and the guilt I had for some of the things I was doing, because when you are an unconscious young girl in Iowa, things happen to you that I got to share with my sponsor on my fourth and fifth step. And they happen more than once, you know, and all that stuff builds up on itself and just makes you feel like a piece of trash. And so makes me feel like a piece of trash. And so I ended up going to college, and I went from being a very good student to 3 D's and an F the first semester. And that's a common theme with us, you know, our alcoholism progresses. And so it was progressing for me, and I thought about ending my life at my sophomore year of college, and I went to a psychologist at the school, and he told me I was in a sophomore slump. He didn't ask me about my drinking. I would have never thought to tell him about my drinking, and I just thought, you're crazy, I'm out of here, and I never went back. And I do want to say that, like, I was always spiritually seeking from the moment I started drinking. When I was in eighth grade, I learned how to do transcendental meditation, because that was really big where I was from. And so I was doing that, and I became a vegetarian. I was doing yoga, and then I got saved, and I went to church a lot. I was rubbing olive oil on the walls, speaking in tongues, and holding the vodka. And then I was, like, doing all the stuff, and then I went to the therapist, and then I was trying to write, like, dark poetry, you know, in college, and I was trying to do all the things. And frankly, there's nothing wrong with any of that stuff. It just wasn't sufficient treatment for my alcoholism. And I ended up realizing that Iowa was the problem in 1998, and I moved to San Diego. And at that time, and my parents weren't like, please don't go. You know, they were like, don't let the door hit you. Like, I embarrassed them. I had a reputation. I was like the bad egg, right? And I don't even know if that's a phrase. Anyway, so I'm like, bad egg. This is what happens when you're tired and old. Like, you just start saying things that don't make sense. And so I moved to San Diego. I come out here, right? I parked my car at my friend's uncle's house, and we go straight to the bar. Like, I don't even go in the house. And I'd driven from Albuquerque that day. I was like, let's go. And And it was on. And instead of coming to, like, on a busy street in Iowa after I had become unconscious somehow with the tires going by my face, I came to with the ocean going over me, you know? And I thought, oh, I need to buckle down. I mean, my drinking is the same thing over and over. Blackout, drunk, drinking hard liquor, drink until I'm unconscious. Things are happening while I'm in that state, day in and day out. And when I'm not drinking, I'm very sick at this point. And when I'm not drinking, I'm thinking about drinking. And the withdrawal is starting to get worse and worse. I just think my hangovers are getting bad, but I'm getting very physically sick because I'm very addicted to alcohol at this point. And like my hands would shake and I would be like, oh, I need a beer for breakfast. You know, I wasn't realizing I was having trouble with what was going on with me. And I thought, oh, I need to buckle down and get it together because I didn't do well in college. And I thought, I'll go to more school and get a career. And I did that. And I buckled down and I got a career. And I'm here to report that that is also not sufficient treatment for alcoholism. It was right after 9/11, and I moved up to Santa Ana for work for my first career job and had my office and, you know, went to the first Christmas party at the Jonathan Club in Los Angeles, and it was all fancy, and I blacked out and got to know a waiter there, and then it got brought up in my review, and one of my bosses was sober, didn't know it, but then I got started getting talked to about my drinking at work, and I was told things like this because I didn't drink at work. I was either still drunk from the night before or withdrawing, and I was like, I need a drink. It's 8 a.m. It's 8:01. It's 8:01 in 5 seconds. And I was like, shh. And I was coming unglued, and I was screaming and cussing and slamming doors, acting in a way you shouldn't be acting at that job. And I was getting talked to by the administrator. They're like, we really like your work, but we think you need a psychiatrist and you need to be on medication. And I was like, you can't tell me what to do, and blah, blah, blah. And really, alcohol had become my master. Alcohol was dictating every day of my life. It had complete control, and I thought I was doing it because I wanted to. And I ended up moving in with a friend because I was having problems paying my bills. And she said, will you go out with me? I was mostly drinking by myself on a floor by myself at this point. And if I was having a good night, I made it to my bed. And, I mean, it was just, it's pathetic to talk about. But she said, why don't you go out with me? I want to go see this person. And I said, okay. So we went out to somewhere. I think it was in Hollywood. Some club. And I didn't know these people. And they had fancy cars. And they were fancy people. And I barfed all over their fancy car and all over the 101. And it's funny, it was no different than any other night. And but there were just people around, and this still small voice inside of me said, nobody else is puking in the car but you. And I find that hilarious that that's the moment I noticed my drinking, out of all the other moments that I should have noticed it. But that's when I noticed it. I was 27 years old. And at this point in time, I was told by a secretary at my job that I don't think he cares if I say his name. Steve is sober 20 years. And I was like, in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like, well, aren't you supposed to be anonymous? Like, why would you tell me that? And I didn't understand why people were telling me that. And people would say, oh, did you tie one on last night? Because I had alcohol coming out of my pores. And I would like put like the mango body butter on that was popular at the time. And then I just smelled like Citron at the time. And I reeked of alcohol every day, and it kept being brought to my attention by my job, and my parents don't know what's going on. The relationships are gone. One by one, friendships go away. One by one, bills don't get paid. The progression is slow, and I'm getting isolated. And that happened that night with those people, and my friend had to drive my car home, and I didn't realize it till later, but when I traded my car in when I got sober, I had vomited all over the side, and I had eaten all the fabric on the side of the car. And I was like, because you don't drive on the passenger side, so I didn't notice it till way later. And I drove drunk a lot, you know. I drove drunk a lot on the 405, and I only didn't drive drunk that night because I wasn't conscious. She drove. Anyway, so I come to the next day. Oh no, that's a lie. I tried to I'm sorry, I'm a little bit tired and a little all over the place. I tried to control and enjoy my drinking. We read it in the chapter 3 tonight, more about alcoholism, all the different things we try to do. And this is where my chapter 3 comes in. And I have that experience where that still small voice inside of me said, no one's vomiting in this car but you. And so my first experiment was, I'm going to have a Diet Coke between martinis because I'm thirsty. It's the desert. And I'm thirsty. That's all that's wrong. I'm just thirsty. I never had a Diet Coke because once I put the vodka in my body, I just want more. And then the next thing I tried to do is not drink except on the weekends, and the weekends start on Thursday. And I couldn't not drink on Monday, and I was sick on Tuesday. And I couldn't not drink on Tuesday, and I was sick on Wednesday. And I couldn't not drink on Wednesday. And that went on for about 6 more months like that. And I realized alcohol had a hold on me. But in my head, I had the beginnings of a possible drinking problem. But I knew I had a problem at that point. And I went on drinking for about 6 more months. And fall to May, whatever that is. And I drove home one last night. I had gone to one of my boss's houses in Newport Beach, and they were drinking. And that it was weird that night. I was just drinking literally in the corner by myself where they're all socializing. And I'm just in the corner drinking. And they would walk by and fill up my drink and then walk off. And just kind of like pathetic. And then I want to get sober. Sorry, I'm kind of going on. But I drove home one last night in a blackout, and I remember leaving Newport Beach and going to Long Beach, and my car, I just remember like getting there, my car almost hitting the garage door. I was like, oh, I made it. And the next day I came to and I said, I can't do this anymore. I can't live this way anymore. I can't do this one more day. And it wasn't, I'm going to get sober in AA, I'm going to do the steps, I'm going to sponsor women, I'm going to be sponsored. I just was like, I can't live this way anymore. And the other thing I want to tell you is my Aunt Donna, my mom's sister, was sober 20 years also. And I met my Aunt Donna drunk. I was drunk, not her. The year before, she was in Pasadena, or Studio City in Pasadena, visiting friends. She lived in Hawaii at the time. And I met her. I didn't know her. And she was put in my life. So anyway, what happens to me is I don't drink, and I don't go to AA, and I detox at home. And this is a 6-week period. And I was sicker than I've ever been in my life. I did not know what was happening with me. I thought I was having a mental breakdown. Probably was. But I was sweating. I wasn't sleeping. I was like, my legs were doing this on the fitted sheet. I was like, I was freaking out. And I don't really know what was happening to me. But I do now. I know I was withdrawing from alcohol, but I didn't understand it. I thought I was going crazy because I didn't understand the nature of my illness that I learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I was very bloated, my face was very red and blotchy, the white parts of my eyes were starting to yellow, I was very physically sick. Just by removing alcohol, I physically changed. I kind of deflated, and my color got better over a period of a few weeks. My boss noticed I looked different. He goes, Ann, what are you doing, working out? What's going on? And I need you to know that at the end of that 6-week period, every night I'm crying, like my eyes out, because I realized, and I have not read our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've never been in AA, but internally I came to the conclusion that I can't drink and I can't not drink, and I'm going to have to commit suicide. And that's where I was when I got to you guys, completely without hope. And that's when Steve stepped in, and he walked in and he said, Ann, what are you doing working out? You look different. What's going on? And my coworker Gary came, this is my impression, I don't know if it's really happened this way, but he came out of his, I thought he came flying out of his office and said, that's because Ann stopped drinking. And I was like, I was super full, really dry, let's put it that way. I was very irritated. And because I was just hanging on as best I could. And ultimately Steve came in my office and shut the door, and it was one alcoholic talking to another. And he told me about his death march into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like, I didn't know what was happening. And he said, you know, Ann, this might be the only window open in the cosmos for you to get sober, and I suggest you walk through it. And I believed that with my whole heart and soul. And he goes, here's the CD. You have to go to Santa Barbara tomorrow. And I was like, okay. And I thought it was music. I did not realize it was an AA speaker. And so it was Sister Maurice from the Bronx. And I laughed and I cried, and she said, Alcoholics Anonymous taught her to what thine own self be true really means, and to love thy neighbor as thyself, not instead of thyself. And for some reason, those two things resonated with me to the point where I remember them 20 years later. And I didn't realize I was identifying with another member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I brought the CD back to Steve the next day, and I was like, can I have another CD? I'm like, I don't need to go to meetings. I will stay sober by CD, and I don't need to go to meetings. And now we don't even have CD players in our cars anymore. But, well, maybe I do. Anyway, but anyway, he said, why don't you go to a meeting with my friend Lisa? And because my boss was saying that and I didn't have any other way to make money, I was like, okay. And I didn't want to go to a meeting. I didn't want to be here. But I didn't have any better answer, you know? I was completely ready to end it all, and I had a plan. And I went to my first meeting at 15th and Balboa in Newport Beach, and it had different people coming up to the podium and reading, and I remember when they read Chapter 5, and I did not stand up and say I was new. I did not identify. So if you're new and you're not identifying, I want to welcome you, because that was exactly where I was. I'm like, I don't know if I want to be in this, you know? And different people came up to the podium and shared their experience, and I remember hearing Chapter 5 the first time, and I was like, those are the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like, ooh. And then people came up and shared their experience, and some of them had different experience than me. They had been homeless. They had gone to prison. They had lost their children. They had gone through different things, but I identified with their how they drank, their alcoholism, and I wanted to identify with their sobriety. And the very first meeting, without saying a word to anyone else, all the hair on the back of my neck stood straight up, and I said, oh my gosh, I'm an alcoholic. That's what's been wrong with me my whole life. And at the same time, I had that gratitude. I was like, oh no, I'm an alcoholic. That means I have to do these stupid steps and go to these stupid meetings. I'm going to kill myself. And I was kind of, you know, and it talks about that in the big book, that, you know, accepting a spiritual solution or going to the bitter end isn't always an easy choice for us. And I identify with that. And so Lisa bought me my first big book that night, and she said, meet me at another meeting tomorrow. And I followed her around for about 2 weeks. And at some point during that 2 week period, I stood up and I said, I'm Anna and I'm an alcoholic. And I cried when I said it, because I knew the gig was up and I had to do something. And then, I don't know if it was Steve or Lisa that said this to me, but they said, oh, you're up in Long Beach. You should go to Bellflower Big Book Group and ask for Karen or Johnny. And I'm like, does anyone have a last name? Like, Karen and Johnny are the most standard names ever. And I had a little bit of a bad attitude for a few years. And my nickname, Johnny's nickname for me, was Joy to the World. So, you'd be like, oh, here comes joy to the world. And so, anyway, they sent me up to Bellflower. I'd been going to smaller meetings, and Bellflower, as you know, is a big speaker meeting, and I walked in there, and I now know it's my friend Ron, but he was there, first person in line. I said, hi, I'm Anna, is Karen or Johnny here? And they pointed, and Karen was right there. And I said, hi, I'm Ann. Lisa sent me. And she said, hi, welcome. Do you have a sponsor? And I said, no. And she goes, I'm going to be your sponsor. Go get in the greeting line. I'm like, okay. And that's how I got my sponsor. And I got in the greeting line because I thought that's just what you guys did. I didn't know to say no to an AA request. I just wanted to blend. And I stood in that greeting line every Monday. And then after, I don't remember the meeting because I think I was a little overwhelmed by the size of it, but at the end of the meeting, she said, call me at 7:30 tomorrow morning. And I've been calling her at 7:30 in the morning every day for 20 years. And now, right now, we're 7:20. So we're on school schedule for my son. But I call her every day. And she took me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as it's outlined in the big book. And I did it with a bad attitude. I did it kicking and screaming. She had me go to meetings every day. I had to get up there early, stay late, get a commitment in the rooms, reach my hand out to the newcomer. I said, but I'm new. She goes, you have 60 days. You go reach your hand out and help someone else. Give people rides. And I was like, I don't like this. And I did it, though. And some weeks I'd be in that greeting line at Monday night, and I'd be like, welcome to AA. I hope you have a great meeting. And I'd have a good attitude. Like, I just want to compliment this group. Like, you are so welcoming to me and so kind and so nice. And I just really appreciated it tonight because I've been in a mood, and I really appreciated it. And I have to do an inventory. And so I might do it tonight. But anyway, that's enough. Sorry. We continue to take the steps. And so anyway, and then some Mondays I would be just crying. I couldn't stop crying. And I'd be like, welcome to AA. And then the next week I'd be really rageful, like really angry. I'm like, what's up? Move it. Move along. You know, and I was crazed. But my point in telling you that is that I was at the meeting. I was in the green room. Like how I felt, what my emotions were on any given day when I was early in recovery didn't matter. And Karen kind of explained it to me. She's like, you don't have the solution of alcohol, and you don't totally have the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous yet. You're in like a purgatory. She's like, we got to get you through all the steps. I'm like, okay. And so we went through the steps. When I did my inventory, I had no trouble identifying what a resentment was. I had plenty of those, and my family was all at the top. And And the day it was February 5th, 2005 is when I read it to her. And I remember that she gave me a calendar that was from her sister who's deceased that said cleaning out your heart. And I got in a fight with her that day and I said, I don't trust you. And I was not nice to sponsor. And she was calling her sponsor back in Ohio saying, do I have to put up with this little blank? And, you know, things like that. And her sponsor said, she's just scared. And I was. And she came over to my apartment there in Long Beach and we got on our knees and we said the third step prayer. And I read her everything. And I had hidden some of my really bad stuff at the very back. I separated the pages. Tips for the newcomer. Just kidding. And I read her that too. And it was the first time in my life I had been 100% honest about everything in my life with another human being. And I cried, and I did not feel great about myself, but for the first time I had hope. Hope that I didn't have to be that woman on that paper. Hope that I didn't have to react to life that way anymore. Hope that I could be different going forward. And I'm here to tell you that taking the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and continuing to take the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous completely transformed and saved my life. Then we moved on to my character defects, and as you have heard, I had an anger problem, and I had to make amends to the bank, and this is during sobriety. This isn't before I got sober. I would act out in public. I would squeal my tires. I got out of my car in Norwalk and screamed at someone behind me. You know, I just was a little unhinged, and as I went to more meetings and took the steps and helped other women and took them through the steps, those episodes were further apart, and I haven't done that in a long time now. I may think it still. I may get a little riled up, but I think part of it is aging, like I'm just mellowing out. But I haven't done those behaviors in a long time. And so my father and I were estranged from one another when I got sober. And all my other amends, I owed like $14,000 in credit card debt, which seems like a nice amount to me right now, because I'm in more debt right now. Anyway, but there's a good reason for that. But then, and that took a long time to pay off, but I paid it off. And then I made direct amends to my mom and the other people I owed amends to by, she had me write it out, and I'd have to say, I apologize for X, Y, and Z. I was wrong. I want to know what I can do to make it right, because an amend means to change. I had to change my behavior. And if there's anything else I'm forgetting, please let me know that too. And my mom had a laundry list of things I was forgetting. And at the ready, like she, I don't think she even knew I was calling to make amends. And so with my dad, though, we were estranged from each other. I actually had to get his phone number from someone because I didn't even have his phone number. And Karen's direction for me with that was, I want you to call your dad and ask if you can start calling him at a day and time convenient for him. And I was like, no, thanks. And I sat on that direction for 3 months. And I got in a lot of pain. And ultimately, in the toothpaste aisle at Target one night, I was either going to go left or right, and left is to the liquor store, and right is towards the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I picked up that heavy phone, and my dad answered on the first ring, and I said, I could barely talk. I was like, Dad, this is Ann. I was wondering if I could start calling you today and tell him, he was okay. And he said, I would love that. And I was like, that was not the dad I was expecting. And I went through a period of time thereafter where I called him Saturday at 8 a.m. and left a voicemail, and he would not call me back. And I did that week in and week out and week in and week out. And I told Karen, I'm like, I made a good faith effort. He doesn't want to talk to me. I'm not surprised by that. And he's not calling me back and he's not answering. And this is where a strong sponsorship comes in. She says, it doesn't matter what he's doing. It matters what you're doing. Be consistent. That was not what I wanted to hear. And very slowly, he started to answer the phone. And we started to form a relationship. And I'm very close with my dad today, and he's in an assisted living today in Iowa in a little room, and I get to be a daughter to him. And I would not have had the experiences I've had with my dad over the last 20 years and the friendship and the close relationship, father-daughter relationship, had it not been for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not going to lie, I've had to do the relationship, you know, and he's a kind, loving man, but I've had to take the action. You know, he responds to it, but I have to take the action. And I get to go see him next month, so I'm excited. Anyway, I'm not saying that one was related to the other, but I met my husband shortly thereafter when we started forming a relationship with my dad. And I showed up for an AA commitment in San Diego. It was a 12 and 12 study, similar to Under the Bridge in Long Beach. It's called Over the Bridge in San Diego. And I was talking on steps 4 and 5, and my now husband was in the room, and he said, you know, step 4 in the 12 and 12 talks about forming a true partnership. And I was a smart aleck from the podium, and I said, oh, if you're asking me if I have a boyfriend, the answer's no. I said it right from the podium. I was like, you need to know who you're getting involved with on the front end. And so he got my number. Anyway, someone played matchmaker in AA, and very awkwardly and slowly we dated with the strong help of our sponsors. It was really awkward for me. And so we dated long distance for about 2 years, and then I moved down to San Diego a little over 10 years ago. We got married. We have an 8-year-old son named Joseph. I had him when I was 40, and I never thought I'd be a mom or have a family. But I'm also here to report that having a husband who's even in AA and having a son is not treatment for alcoholism. I have to continue to do these things so that I can be a sober wife and a sober mom. And life continues to happen whether I'm sober or not. I became very close with my close friend Carrie. We were like best friends in AA. We did everything together for 12 years, and she got breast cancer and she passed away at 55 years old. And that was very painful. But I got to be of service to her and her family. I didn't make it about me, and that's a gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I got to hold her hand when she was at her end of life stage and say the Lord's Prayer, because we said that in all our meetings in Long Beach, and I knew that would give her comfort, you know. And she did. You could see her settle when I said it, you know. And I'm really grateful for that friendship, because she was someone that really lived the program and opened her home. Everyone could come over. Everyone could watch the Dodger game. Everyone could go in the pool, you know. Anytime I lose someone close to me like that, I try to like take something I learned from them and go take it into my life. And Karen always helps me when someone passes. She always has me write a gratitude list about them and then another numbered list of everything I learned from them. And I read it to her, and it helps me process my grief. And my Aunt Donna has been battling stage 4 breast cancer since 2019. She's had breast cancer since 2009. She's doing okay. And she's going to be 40 years sober on Sunday. And we just talked this morning. Like, those relationships and those gifts, and then the women I sponsor, there's no price tag on that, you know? And the women I sponsor, when I moved to San Diego, it was a little weird for me. So if anyone's moved out here from somewhere else and is doing new meetings, I want to welcome you. And I would know what that feels like to, like, relocate and be. I felt like I was new again at 10 years, and I had to integrate into meetings down there and get commitments and get there early and stay late, you know, and then start sponsoring women down there. And, you know, the women I sponsor keep me in the book. They help me more than I'll ever help them. And they're the light of my life. That phone of mine rings all the time. And I'm like, thank you, God. Thank you, God, for Alcoholics Anonymous, for giving me such a deep sense of peace no matter what life is throwing at me. You know, I just have to continue to do these things, continue to take the steps, and continue to reach my hand out. So if you're new, what's worked for me is I got a home group, I got a sponsor, I took the steps, and then I passed it on to others after me. So thank you for asking me to share, and that's all I have. Thanks.